LNS catalog number 10279.
The mockingbird probably enjoys the reputation of being the foremost songbird in America. Certainly he is the best known because he does not hide his talents in the north woods where only a few may hear, but holds forth in park and garden and city streets throughout the southland from coast to coast. Nor is he content with the daylight hours, for even on moonlit nights he bursts forth in romantic melodies that have found their way into the hearts of poets and songwriters. The song presented herewith is that of a normal Florida bird, not given to much variation, but further north the mockingbirds enjoy a reputation for mimicry excelled by no other bird. Have you heard this sound before? Probably not. This voice, like mine, comes to you in Berlin via Seattle, Washington, where I'm actually attending a different conference. Sort of. This voice, or one similar to it, was previously broadcast over radio in Ithaca, New York, in 1940. And actually, that performance of it in 1940 had been recorded on a summer expedition in Florida in 1935. That is, the individual bird that just made this sound was last directly experienced in Florida in 1935. But here we are now, displaced in space, but nevertheless listening together to a sound from the past. Shall we listen again? This is actually a different recording that was made on the same day, on the same expedition in Florida in 1935, at the same location, so I think it actually might be the same individual. Listen. Please play Mockingbird number 2.
LNS catalog number 10280.
The description I opened with was actually a passage from the radio script of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's weekly radio program that ran from the 1930s through the 1980s. This episode was titled Birds of Southern Woods and Gardens. It's undated in the archives, but I think it's actually from like 1939, 1940 or so. Usually that description precedes the sound recording, and it ends with the command, listen. In preparing this talk for you today, I found myself smiling frequently in response to this command and the sound that followed it. The mockingbird is actually quite common where I live now in rural Mississippi, but it's also a sound I've heard my whole life growing up in the United States. It's a joyful, bubbling sound that I connect to my childhood in California. I want to talk today about the first time radio listeners heard sounds recorded in the wild from other places. Certainly recorded and replayed music has been available on the phonograph since the 19-teens, and it displaced live performed music and radio dramas. Displaced live performed music and radio dramas had been available via radio broadcasts beginning in the 1920s. It was in the 1930s, however, that shifting listener expectations of sound effects and a new effort to educate the public about natural resource conservation when these two things converged. So in 1939, the sound of that Florida mocker poured out of radio receivers. I would like to claim here in both Seattle and Berlin today that these sounds of nature recorded in the wild, broadcast for listeners far from the original sounding body, the sounding creature, made it possible for radio listeners to think about space, time, and ultimately the extinction of species in an entirely new way. In the 1920s, the radio was embraced as a new medium for education. Several universities established colleges of the air to broadcast radio courses on topics that would range from poetry to agricultural science. Among the proliferation of these educational radio programs were several that were devoted to nature explicitly. Some of these, one titled A Field with Ranger Mac, and another one titled Burgess Radio Nature League, these were explicitly oriented towards children. They would encourage them to make bird feeders and to not kill snakes, and children would write in with questions and then they would be answered on the air. Programs were also, of course, developed for adults, and these initially followed the format of the science shows that had been launched by the Smithsonian Institute, and these would showcase local experts. They'd come in and give lectures about some field of their expertise. In 1933, Aldo Leopold, who is now considered the father of natural resource management, wildlife conservation, he launched a series of monthly talks for the Wisconsin College of the Air program. And he would talk about, to his, you know, mostly rural listeners about this project of conservation. And he would ask them to leave cover and food for the wintering birds. Implicitly, Leopold also encouraged listeners to engage one's surroundings with curiosity and with care. He continuously emphasized the need for a land ethic and advocated for this by giving private landowners explicit instructions, again, for managing their land in an ecologically ethical way, and then he would sort of give examples of people that were already doing so. In 1937, there was a new collaboration between sportsmen, so these are hunters and fishermen, as well as businessmen. They collaborated together. They called themselves the American Wildlife Institute, and they launched a weekly radio show devoted to wildlife conservation. And whereas the College on the Air programs were structured like actual courses, there would be lectures, maybe some engagement via letter correspondence, and in a couple cases, actual supplementary publications and local newspapers to be read aloud at the YMCA. These AWI, this American Wildlife Institute programs, instead, they evolved to borrow heavily from popular radio drama formats that had been pioneered by its parent affiliate, Mutual Broadcasting System. Mutual Broadcasting was best known at the time for shows like The Lone Ranger and The Shadow. They also broadcast the Baseball World Series, so these were much more, you know, sort of culturally resonant and very popular radio dramas and live news coverage. The American Wildlife Institute programs, similarly, would include sound effects and dramatic plots. They have a script titled Wildlife Gangsters and Roar of the River, and this last one was actually about floods that resulted from poor wetlands management. So here's an excerpt from a radio drama of American Wildlife Institute. This is a dialogue between young Bud and his Uncle Bob. Listen. Please play Bud and Uncle Bob.
America's Wildlife Problems, dramatically presented. Uncle Bob and Bud the Boy Scout are finishing the dishes at their camp in the woods.
What's that?
An old horned owl. He's liable to catch a rabbit directly. That's a sound I never get used to.
Just the same, you're always sticking up for hawks and owls. You tell me not to shoot them unless I'm sure they're killing more than their share of game. You wouldn't let me try an arrow on an owl just yesterday, remember?
Why, son, we've been doing away with the homes of wildlife, robbing wildlife of its means of making a living for itself. We've drained our swamps and poisoned our rivers and destroyed our grazing lands and cleaned off the timber. We haven't been putting it back. I mean, the way we should. Now we've got to undo the things we've done. Got to get together and help each other do the job. There has to be teamwork, whether it's keeping camp the way you and I do, or saving the outdoors. Teamwork, yes, sir.
But we'll always have the outdoors, swamps and woods and camps like this, won't we?
We won't if we don't do something about it. If we just sit back and take it easy, the whole country would be a dust bowl and blow away. That would take quite a while, I admit. But I might never know the good old times again, and you might never have the fun I had.
Let me repeat those last two lines. Bud says, "But we'll always have the outdoors, won't we?" And his Uncle Bob replies, "We won't if we don't do something about it. If we sit back and take it easy, the whole country would be a dust bowl and blow away. And that would take quite a while, but I might never know the good times, and you might never have the fun I had." So here the conservation message is pretty explicit. And the premise for the conversation between Bud and Uncle Bob about natural resource management is the sound of an owl. And I want to deconstruct this a little bit more. There's the sound of the owl. Listen, please play the owl. And then Bud says he finds this unsettling. But Uncle Bob redirects and offers a different understanding of the sound. "No, no, that sound doesn't indicate danger. The owl won't hurt you. In fact, we humans are threatening the owl's habitat." And then Bud has this little kind of aw shucks realization. And the listeners, they are also Bud. And Bud is us. In this way, the American Wildlife Institute drew on tropes and techniques developed in the previous decade of radio play to draw listeners with credible sound effects and compelling storytelling. As far as I can tell, none of these conservation radio programs employed sounds of nature that were recorded in the wild. They're often created through sound effect techniques or recorded at zoos and private collections of tame animals. The nature sounds, were introduced to radio audiences for the first time by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Know Your Birds radio program. And here, sounds that were recorded in the wild were presented in a format that was actually quite similar to field guides. Radio audiences would hear a short description of the species' range and behavior, and then the command, "Listen." And then the recorded sound of the wild bird would be played. These shows by Cornell were highly local in the sense that they usually opened with discussions of recent migratory arrivals in Ithaca, where Cornell is located. Residents of the Greater Finger Lakes region would write in with their own weekly bird count. So this is the larger region around Ithaca. Residents would write in with their own weekly bird counts, and then they would listen very carefully, and even in many cases with a touch of jealousy, they listened very carefully to the radio to hear announcements of sightings of rare birds that had been made by their neighbors. They also listened very carefully to the quality of the sound recordings, and they would compare, say, the broadcasted recording of a veery to the one they regularly heard in their own backyard. One letter writer actually expressed disappointment that the quality recording of one of the veeries that Cornell played was nearly unrecognizable. She said she was quite disappointed by this. Another wrote to request that the radio producers play a recording of the orchard oriole's call because she hadn't heard one in years. So here we have, I think, an interesting interplay of memory and authenticity. Some listeners criticized the leading ornithological institution in the country for a sound that didn't align with their memory of it. Others sought out nature sounds on the radio, explicitly asked them to play certain songs out of nostalgia. These programs also, I would argue, prompted listeners to think about their own sound environment relative to much more far-flung ones. So recall the mockingbird. For many of you, that was a species you'd heard of, perhaps, but never experienced directly. For listeners in Ithaca, New York, in the late 1930s, that very same recorded sound was a similar experience. They'd never experienced it directly. The very same sound allowed them to transcend time and space via sound. One listener wrote in that the bird sounds broadcast during that Birds of Southern Woods and Garden show reminded her of her winters in Florida. Another exclaimed, "Why go to Florida when we can hear a bird concert from our own home?" Why indeed, if radio could bring the birds to you? So the radio sounds of nature fostered new ways of listening, I think, in two steps. First, as part of a conservation radio program with a more familiar context of radio drama and schools of the air to articulate messages of natural resource conservation. Second, in a more kind of explicit program that was devoted to showcasing recordings made of wild birds in their natural habitats. And in this way, listeners were prompted to consider their own sonic environment relative to those of other times and places. Again, why go to Florida when you can hear the bird concert in your own home? I think these are critical steps in the development of what I'm calling imagined ecologies. That is the phenomenon in which the individual begins to think of themselves as part of an interdependent, multi-species community. So this draws on the work of Benedict Anderson, his concept of imagined communities, as well as the work of ethnomusicologist Jeff Titan, where he talks about this multi-species sound commons. And you might feel like you are part of some multi-species community, even if you do not know or even able to communicate with all of the species. I argue that the role of nature sounds heard via radio was central in shaping our understanding, not just of the sonic environment, but the environment generally in the 20th century. Here, though, I think it's worth emphasizing that the combination of recorded nature sounds and replaying them over radio also collapsed time and space, and in doing so, revealed tensions of dislocated sounding bodies. In some cases, listeners never had or would experience these individuals directly, and yet this dislocation in time and space potentially fostered a new form of empathy, especially when presented in the context of conservation radio or information about the species. The listeners could think of these creatures as something other than curiosities. Rather, they were sonic kin. The letters to Cornell suggest that hearing these sounds often fostered something like affection. Keep in mind that this was at least part of the intent of these programs, right? To encourage responsible natural resource management, to care about these ecosystems. Here, consider the sound of the now extinct ivory-billed woodpecker. This recording is from that same 1935 expedition that collected those other Florida sounds. Listen. Please play the ivory-billed woodpecker.
LNS catalog number 6784.
This sound will never be heard in nature again. It will only be heard via speaker or headphones or some sort of mediating technology. And perhaps this is a good time to talk briefly about individuals as representatives of species and the limits of the collecting sciences. If one of the goals of collecting these sounds was to create an archive of sorts, maybe the irony is that this project was pretty much too late. This is the one sound file of this species, the ivory-billed woodpecker. We have no way of knowing if it is representative. And for species like the mockingbird, it is impossible for any sound recording to be representative. The mockingbird is known as, you know, both a creative singer, but also an incredibly talented mimic. So they mimic their immediate sonic environment. They are very much bound to their specific time and place. So each individual song is, again, bound to specific time and place. The knowledge that this bird is a mimic, I think, keeps us honest as historians and as listeners. The sound cannot come from any bird other than the original individual. That is, no single mockingbird can represent its species, nor can an individual even represent its own typical song. Every time it opens its beak, a new sound emerges. But I think it is this very feature of highly specific dislocation that prompts listeners to think about their own environment in a new way, and perhaps with a bit of empathy as well. Consider the way in which you just experience the ivory-billed woodpecker sound, knowing that that bird is gone. Just as listeners cared about characters in the radio dramas they tuned into weekly, they also cared about the individual bird voices that they heard in their own living room. I think there might be something to say here as well about how this narrative that I've described to you today fits into maybe a larger discussion about standardization and universalization. It's an uncomfortable fit. Certainly sound effect techniques for radios were being standardized at this time, and in turn, listeners were participating in the standardization of the sounds themselves and expectations, really, about what was considered an acceptable sound for a lion's roar or the sound of thunder or the clip-clop of horses. Listeners at this time cultivated what I would say was an overconfidence in their abilities to judge the authenticity of the sound. That is, how many of them or even of us have stood in front of an actual lion while it roared? How do we know that this MGM lion actually sounds like a lion? Or do we care? As radio collapsed, entertainment and conservation messaging, the dislocation of bodies, the separation of birds from their own voices was meaningful to listeners because of their specificity in time and space. So though these shows were only possible due to the impulses to standardize and universalize sound, these impulses that were perpetuated by sound engineers and natural scientists alike, listeners cared about individuals. These sounds were wonderful and wondrous because they originated elsewhere, not unlike my own voice here and now. So I'll stop there. Thank you all for listening.